For Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
A prominent Muslim cleric is killed in Kenya, and Nigeria's Boko Haram is suspected in more kidnappings. I'm Frances Alonso reporting from Washington. Gunmen have shot and killed a prominent Muslim cleric in Mombasa. It's the fourth religious leader to be killed in the Kenyan city in the past 2 years. Police say Sheikh Mohammed Idris, the chairman of Kenya's Council of Imams and Preachers, was fatally shot outside a mosque this morning. There has been no claim of responsibility for the attack. Investigators say the moderate cleric had been threatened by radical Muslim youths and he feared for his life. Suspected Boko Haram militants have kidnapped 20 women near the town where the group abducted more than 200 schoolgirls in April. Witnesses said Monday the gunmen drove into the northeastern Garkan Fulani settlement and forced the women into their vehicles. They say the abductions took place on Thursday. The government did not immediately comment on the reported kidnappings. South African President Jacob Zuma will miss his new government's first cabinet meeting following a hospital stay for apparent exhaustion. The president's office says Mr. Zuma is resting at home this week and will not attend the three-day conference that began Tuesday in Pretoria. The 72-year-old leader left a Pretoria hospital late on Sunday, a day after he was admitted for what his office called a thorough checkup and rest after a demanding election campaign. Israel's parliament has elected a new president. With details now, Robert Berger has this report from Jerusalem.
The speaker of the 120-member Knesset, Israel's parliament, announced Reuven Rivlin was elected the nation's 10th president. Rivlin, 74, opposes the creation of a Palestinian state and is a senior member of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's right-wing Likud party. Mr. Netanyahu described Rivlin as a man of Jerusalem and a man of the land of Israel. He said the new president has two main tasks, to unite the nation internally and externally to be an ambassador for Israel to the world. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Radical Sunni Muslim militants seized control of Iraq's second largest city of Mosul today in a stunning defeat for the Shiite-led Iraqi government. One Iraqi military commander called the fall of Mosul a total collapse for the security forces. An Iraqi government official said the city was at the mercy of the militants. Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki asked parliament to call an urgent session to declare a state of emergency. United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights Navi Pillay has issued a stinging rebuke to the international community for remaining indifferent to widespread atrocities committed around the world. In a final speech to the UN Human Rights Council before leaving her post, Pillay said politics has too often taken precedence over human rights. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Navi Pillay will have served 6 years as UN High Commissioner for Human Rights when she steps down on September 1st. She has been an outspoken champion of human rights.
Regrettably, the international community remains unable to consistently react strongly and quickly to crises.
Pillay leaves a full agenda of human rights violations for her successor, including the deteriorating situation in Ukraine. She leaves while the UN sets up a field office in South Korea to monitor widespread abuses in North Korea. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
U.S. defense officials say five American troops were killed during a Monday security operation in southern Afghanistan, possibly by so-called friendly fire. Pentagon Press Secretary Rear Admiral John Kirby said today that investigators are looking into the likelihood that friendly fire was a cause and that our thoughts and prayers are with the families of these fallen. Nearly 2 months after South Korea's ferry disaster killed over 300 people, the captain and crew who abandoned the ship are standing trial on charges including murder. The ferry captain and three crew members are charged with homicide through willful negligence and face a possible death sentence. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Gunmen believed to be Boko Haram militants have abducted at least 20 women, not far from a town where the insurgents kidnapped more than 200 teenage schoolgirls in April. As the search continues for the girls, analysts say the latest kidnapping is yet another disaster in a region descending into chaos.
That's Heather Murdoch reporting from Abuja. Details next. Also in the news, the chairman of the Kenyan Religious Council has been shot dead in the city of Mombasa. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from South Africa, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, gunmen believed to be Boko Haram militants have abducted at least 20 women not far from a town where the insurgents kidnapped more than 300 teenage schoolgirls in April. As the search continues for the girls, analysts say the latest kidnapping is yet another disaster in a region descending into chaos. Heather Murdoch reports from Abuja.
More than a month ago, Nigerian activists captured international attention as they took to the streets demanding the rescue of schoolgirls kidnapped by Boko Haram. The Nigerian government and governments around the world pledged to find the girls. They have now been missing for almost 2 months, and more women and girls have been kidnapped. Andrew Strohlein, the European Media Director for Human Rights Watch, says Boko Haram's now five-year-old insurgency has resulted in crimes against humanity.
Kidnappings have gone on before. Kidnappings of girls at schools have gone on before. These kinds of abuses, entire villages eradicated. There's a humanitarian crisis. There's a whole wave of murder and mayhem by Boko Haram that is essentially crimes against humanity.
The women were kidnapped at gunpoint last week from an area called Garkin Fulani, a nomadic cowherding settlement. Locals said three young men tried to stop gunmen from forcing the women into a truck, and they too were captured. This comes as violence appears to be again on the rise in northeastern Nigeria, where three states have been under emergency rule for more than a year. E.J. Hodgendorn is the Deputy Director for Africa at the International Crisis Group in Washington, D.C. He says as the Boko Haram insurgency continues to grow more deadly, some of the core problems that allowed the group to emerge in the first place, like extreme poverty, lack of development, and widespread corruption, have not been addressed. He says while the group is recognized as an international terrorist group by several countries, including the United States, it is essentially a Nigerian problem.
This is not some kind of international terrorist group necessarily, but that this is a homegrown problem that was allowed to fester until it's become this monster that they can no longer control.
Boko Haram has killed thousands of people, including hundreds of schoolchildren, and the United Nations estimates 500,000 people have fled their homes because of the insurgency. In a video released last month, Abubakar Shekau, who claims to lead Boko Haram, showed footage of about 100 girls, many who were later identified as the kidnapped schoolgirls. Shekau, not seen with the girls in the video, then threatened to kidnap more women and girls to be held as slaves, sold into marriage, or held as vengeance for the wives and children of Boko Haram members in Nigerian prisons. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
More than 300 heavily armed men suspected to be members of the Nigerian radical group Boko Haram have attacked the locality of Gorsi Turu in northern Cameroon, burning churches and looting property. Moki Edwin Kinzeka has the story from the Cameroonian capital, Yaounde.
These villagers who have fled Gorsi Turu village in far northern Cameroon are praying for God's protection from the radical Islamist group Boko Haram. They escaped their village after a group of more than 300 heavily armed men began looting, burning houses, and destroying property. Village chief Musa Sambu who was invited by Cameroonian authorities to the capital, Yaoundé, tells VOA the invaders have been on the hills of Gossé-Tourou for 5 days.
Tout a commencé vendredi aux environs de 17 heures, lorsqu'il pleuvait encore.
He says it all started on Friday at about 5 p.m. when there was a heavy downpour. He says heavy gunfire was heard and there was total panic, adding the invaders looted food, money and goods. Sambo says some of the attackers had taken position on the hills surrounding their village and could monitor the movements of Cameroon's military, which arrived about 2 hours later and engaged the militants in battle. Cameroon's Minister of Communication and Government spokesperson, Issa Chiruma, tells VOA that there were many casualties, including assailants, a Cameroonian soldier, and a villager. He also says soldiers drove back the attackers.
Our defense forces responded and one of their vehicles and a war weapon of Kalashnikov type seized, defeated. The attackers went on the run and disappeared within the Nigeria territory.
But Musa disputes the claim that the militants fled back to Nigeria. He says Cameroon soldiers were not able to get to the top of the hills where the assailants were hiding. When VOA asked Issa Chiruma if he was certain that the assailants had left, he said he was calling on citizens to report any suspicious activities in their vicinity.
I call on you fellow citizens, be it elite, traditional rulers, peasants, farmers, drivers, to watch out and accompany our administrative authorities and defense forces in bringing them the collaboration they need in terms of information, intelligence, or denunciation, and help them to successfully conduct their mission assigned to them.
7 bodies believed to be killed Boko Haram members were buried in the village by Cameroonian soldiers, while other corpses were taken away by the militants to the bushes. It is the first attack by suspected Boko Haram fighters on the village, situated some 400 kilometers from where the violent Islamist group has previously operated within Cameroon. Some believe the latest violence indicates the group is looking for other entry points into Cameroon after the government declared war on Boko Haram and deployed troops to areas where the militants attacked in the past. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
The chairman of a Kenyan religious council has been shot dead in the city of Mombasa. Sheikh Mohammed Idris was in the forefront of the fight against radicalization of Muslim youths in the coastal region. Radical youths had accused the cleric of working with the state to suppress them. For VOA, Mohammed Yusuf has more from Nairobi.
Kenyan officials and witnesses say unidentified gunmen on motorcycles killed Sheikh Idris as he left his house Tuesday to attend morning prayers at a nearby mosque. According to the family, the 65-year-old Idris, who chaired the local council of imams and preachers, was shot in the stomach. Idris had been expected to testify in a Mombasa court Wednesday, after he filed a case against radical youths and the committee running Mombasa's Sakina Mosque for wrongful dismissal from his duties. He had been thrown out of the mosque late last year by angry youths armed with knives. Before then, he led prayers and gave sermons at the mosque for 35 years. The son of the slain cleric, Hassan Mohammed Idris, told reporters that for the past 5 months, his father lived a private life.
Sisi kama familia tukasema, washa mambo kama haya, wacha Islam wasibu.
As a family, we told our old man, it was not nice for the Muslims to fight each other because of you. Thank God he agreed to our request and went to Likoni to stay his house and his farm. According to our younger brother, he has seen and known people with vehicles driving near the farm that we do not know. In an interview with VOA in late May, the slain cleric said young radicals were not happy with his stand that fighting in neighbouring Somalia was not jihad or holy war. He also said the youth tormented him and other officials in the streets, calling them names. Religious leaders and government officials have condemned Tuesday's killing and have called on the security agencies to find the killers. Mombasa City Police Commissioner Nelson Marwa said an investigation is underway.
Operation imeanza. Na tungependa kwamba
the operation has started and it will be sustained until the culprits are brought to book, he said. We want to urge the leaders, we want to urge Mombasa residents and religious leaders to be calm and to give the government a chance to do its work. The commissioner also called for witnesses to volunteer information that can help the police to nab the assailants. Sheikh Idris was the fourth prominent Muslim cleric to be gunned down in Mombasa in the past 2 years. The government has yet to apprehend any suspect. Visiting the family of the slain cleric on Tuesday, former Prime Minister Raila Odinga said he was close friend of Sheikh Idris. Odinga noted other Kenyan clerics have been killed in mysterious circumstances. We are asking who is carrying out these killings, he says. Is it a devil waking up one morning and going to fire a bullet at people? Odinga says it is not normal for all these murders to be unresolved, with police making no arrests. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
You are listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Seventeen past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Suspected Boko Haram militants have kidnapped 20 women near the town where the group abducted more than 300 schoolgirls in April. And the chairman of a Kenyan religious council has been shot dead in the city of Mombasa. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237. The International Organization for Migration, IOM, called today for urgent action by the international community to respond to growing populations of North African migrants entering Europe by boat. This past weekend, over 5,470 migrants reached Sicily by boat, bringing the total so far to more than 50,000 people who have risked their lives to enter Italy. Flavio Diagiacomo is a spokesperson for IOM in Rome. He says the number of migrant arrivals this year has already exceeded the 40,000 migrants who sought refuge in Italy in 2013.
The problem is, in our opinion, more a humanitarian problem than the problem of numbers. That's because those people actually, they risk their lives at sea, and it's very complicated to save all these lives. The Italian government is actually carrying out an operation called Mare Nostrum, which started last October. After the shipwreck of October 3rd, there were 368 people died at sea of Lampedusa, and in this month they saved thousands of lives. But it's impossible to avoid shipwrecks. Last month there was a shipwreck on May 13 which caused the death of at least 17 migrants, but maybe more than that, because the witness told us that probably 60 migrants died at sea. So it's very difficult to avoid shipwrecks. So the emergency from this moment for the Italian government is to save lives, and it's also an operational emergency because all these people arrive in just one single entry point, which is the Channel of Sicily.
From a humanitarian perspective, what needs to be done to provide help for these people that are coming into Europe?
It should be important to develop a more comprehensive approach, and no single action is enough to address the root causes of this migration. So IOM is calling for a high-level debate on these flows that could bring together all the countries of destination, of origin and transit, because it is needed to offer alternatives to migrants and to tell them, okay, do not risk your life because you can enter Europe safely. So it should be find a way to enhance the legal avenues for migrants to come to Europe, for example, reinforcing resettlement programs in order to transfer migrants directly to Europe, or, for example, some people also said it would be possible to establish migrant centers in the country of transit or first asylum where migrants can be provided with adequate legal assistance, or maybe they could also present asylum requests directly in the embassies of the European countries. What should be done, of course, is to try to offer alternatives to people, but to take the boat and risk their lives.
Looking at the international community, you're calling on them to help. So how would the international community reduce trafficking and the smuggling of migrants?
Yeah, it is very important to tackle the traffickers, of course. And it's a main problem because cooperation must be reinforced among countries in order to identify and to prosecute the traffickers, because those are people who actually are taking advantage of the desperation of migrants and they are getting rich. So it is needed that all the countries involved in Europe, but in Africa as well, should cooperate, should increase their cooperation in order to crack down on traffickers and smugglers.
And as you are well aware of, it's been in the news with the recent European elections that some right-wing politicians in Europe are expressing opposition to Africans coming into their countries. Are you finding this type of opposition growing?
Migration is a very complicated issue, of course, and it's always at the center of political debate, even if in this period of electoral campaign because of the European elections. Some right-wing parties, of course, said that migrants should not be allowed to come to Italy because they should be, let's say, protected at their home, so they say. But in general, I must say that the attitude a little bit changed in the last few months after the shipwreck of last 3rd of October, for example, about Italy, where for the first time after many years of debates on immigration, the focus went on the humanitarian emergency and the fact that lives were lost at sea. It is quite clear that these people are fleeing from wars, from regimes, and that they are desperate. I would say that I'm quite optimistic about the fact that the public opinion is understanding very well the situation in the last few months.
From Rome, Italy, that was IOM spokesperson Flavio Di Giacomo. He was speaking to VOA's Kim Lewis. United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, Navi Pillay, has issued a stinging rebuke to the international community for remaining indifferent to widespread atrocities committed around the world. In a final speech to the UN Human Rights Council before leaving her post, Pillay said politics has too often taken precedence over human rights. Lisa Schlein reports from the Council in Geneva.
Navi Pillay will have served 6 years as UN High Commissioner for Human Rights when she steps down on September 1st. Throughout her tenure, she has been an outspoken champion of human rights, often risking offending countries by maintaining pressure on governments she deemed culpable of gross, systematic abuse. She did not soften this approach as she deplored the sad state of human rights around the world in her final speech to the 47-member UN Human Rights Council.
Regrettably, the international community remains unable to consistently react strongly and quickly to crises, including situations of grave human rights violations with high potential for regional overspill.
Pillay visited South Sudan in April, a week after the violence and mass slaughter there reached new heights. She said she was shocked by the targeted ethnic attacks and risk of widespread famine, as well as by the seeming indifference of the leaders on both sides of the conflict to this unfolding tragedy. She expressed similar feelings of outrage and alarm at the intercommunal tensions and widespread violence in the Central African Republic. She described the relentless violence in Syria as a tragedy for the Syrian people and a tragic failure for the cause of human rights. She said the bombings, widespread loss of life, and extensive damage to infrastructure in such places as Aleppo should outrage the conscience of humanity. She deplored the willful refusal by Syria's government and some opposition groups to seek a peaceful solution to end the war.
External powers continue to fuel this violence through the supply of arms, military, and other material assistance, as well as inflows of foreign fighters. It is shocking that war crimes and crimes against humanity have become commonplace and occur with complete impunity. I am disappointed that the Security Council, with 13 votes in favor and 2 opposed, has been unable to reach agreement on action to ensure accountability for such crimes.
Russia and China have repeatedly vetoed resolutions aimed at referring Syrian officials suspected of war crimes and crimes against humanity to the International Criminal Court. In her speech, Pillay indicated that violations of human rights involve more than just large-scale abuses, saying human rights starts and ends with the individual. She poignantly highlighted the abduction of hundreds of schoolgirls by the militant Boko Haram in Nigeria. She cited the so-called honor killing in Pakistan of a 23-year-old pregnant woman by her family as another shocking case of violence against women. As she prepares to step down as UN Rights Chief, Pillay leaves a full agenda of human rights violations for her successor, including the deteriorating situation in Ukraine. She leaves while the UN sets up a field office in South Korea to monitor widespread abuses in North Korea. She leaves as her office prepares a comprehensive investigation into alleged atrocities committed in the waning days of Sri Lanka's long civil war with the Tamil Tigers, and with Sri Lanka's government vowing once again not to cooperate with the UN probe. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The use of DNA technology is shedding light on the scope of elephant poaching in Africa. The commissioner for Interpol, the International Criminal Police Organization in Lomé, says DNA tests of ivory tusks seized by Togo authorities in recent months indicate that they come from about 500 elephants killed in 9 countries. The lab tests revealed the ivory came from Ivory Coast, Ghana, Guinea, Liberia, Cameroon, Congo, Gabon, Central African Republic, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. The 2 largest seizures in Togo were made in January when local officials discovered 2 containers that were marked timber. They actually held nearly 4 tons of illegal ivory being smuggled to Asian markets. 3 men were arrested, 2 Togo nationals and 1 from Vietnam. The UN has warned that the ivory trade is an important source of funding for armed militants in Cameroon, the Central African Republic, Chad, and Gabon. Togo's Environment Ministry says none of the tusks were traced to Togo, which has only 115 elephants. The 500 confiscated tusks were worth about $8 million in the international black market. This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Hi, this is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. Visit VOAfootball.com for live updates on the World Cup in Brazil. The site is optimized for your mobile phone or tablet and will bring you the latest scores, stats, photos, and videos. And everything can be shared with your friends from your mobile device to Facebook and Twitter. World Cup nonstop at voafootball.com.
VOA Africa Health Network, a multimedia network reaching 50 million Africans weekly. We bring you relevant, reliable health news and information. We ask you about the health problems most important to you and inform you about health problems impacting your community. VOA Africa Health Network. Visit our website at www.africahealthnetwork.com.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Suspected Boko Haram militants have kidnapped 20 women near the town where the group abducted more than 300 schoolgirls in April. And South Africa's mineral resources minister warns that platinum mines may close if a five-month strike by 80,000 miners does not end soon. Coming up, we have music from South Africa, and in our feature segment, we look into a new study that finds obesity rates for both adults and children climbing worldwide. I'm Kim Lewis with the Hayes Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Tuesday, Sunny.
Happy Tuesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you have lots of World Cup news for us today.
Kim, my cup runneth over with World Cup news. Yes, indeed. Kim, as we look forward to Thursday's official kickoff of the World Cup in Brazil, let's keep in mind this will be the first time goal line technology is used at the 32-nation football jamboree. 14 cameras, 7 focused on each goal mouth, have been hung up in all 12 World Cup stadiums in Brazil. The cameras will record 500 images per second, and a computer will process the frames. Within a second of a ball crossing the line, the referee's special watch will vibrate and flash goal. The small German startup company Goal Control created the technology used to support the referees, something which has been used for years already in sports such as cricket, rugby, tennis, and American-style football. The German company demonstrated the goal line technology at Brazil's famous Maracanã Stadium in Rio de Janeiro, where the World Cup final will be played July 13th. The chief executive officer of Goal Control is Dirk Breuchhausen.
The system works 100% accurate, and we have the possibility that the signals will be sent out after the cams have seen whether the ball crossed the line or not, to send out to referee's watch, and the referee then decides at his sole discretion, okay, is this a goal or not, yes or no.
World football's governing body, FIFA, was persuaded to move to the goal line technology after an incident at the 2010 World Cup in South Africa. England's Frank Lampard was denied a goal against Germany when his shot hit the bar and officials failed to spot the ball had bounced down just behind the line. If it had been ruled a goal, England would have tied the match at 2-2. But Germany went on to win 4-1 in the round of 16 match in Bloemfontein. FIFA has carried out extensive testing of the new technology. Speaking in Rio, the group leader of the FIFA quality program, Johannes Holzmuller, had this to say.
In the preparation of this World Cup, the independent test institute, Laborsport UK, they've tested over 2,400 goal line incidents in the several stadiums here in Brazil. All of these 2,400 goal line incidents were correctly recognized by the system. So yes, we can trust the system. We are sure that it worked 100%.
In more World Cup news, the spirit of the football fiesta has spread to the United Nations in New York. UN ambassadors from all 32 participating countries donned their national team jerseys ahead of Thursday's opening match between Brazil and Croatia in Sao Paulo. As he posed for photographs with the various UN ambassadors, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon talked about his love of football.
Some of you may know that I have played football from time to time with some of the ambassadors here today. I even broke my hand at one point. It took 2 months to heal. I guess I have to stop trying to do that Pelé-style bicycle kick. Today's gathering is an occasion to celebrate the best values of sport, teamwork, fair play, and mutual respect. Over the next month, hundreds of million people will be entertained and enthralled as we follow the action at avenues across Brazil. Regardless of the team we support, we will all be admiring the extraordinary feats of the world's best players. Sports has a unique ability to unite us and to show us what we have in common. There is no better testimony than today's event. What else can get ambassadors to shed their suits and ties and dress like this during daytime? To all the competing teams in Brazil, I wish you the very best. Last year, I had the honor of kicking off the ball at the Real Madrid match. This year, they won the Champions League. I hope to bring all of your teams the same luck.
That's Ban Ki-moon, the Secretary General of the United Nations, speaking at UN headquarters in New York. And I'd love to see Ban Ki-moon do one of those Pele-style bicycle kicks. Yes, indeed. And while the UN Secretary General is wishing good luck to all 32 teams competing at the World Cup in Brazil, I know he has a special allegiance for the South Korean team. The South Korean team could have used a lot more luck Monday night in the southern U.S. city of Miami, Florida. The South Koreans suffered a 4-0 loss to Ghana in a friendly World Cup warm-up match for both teams. The hero for the Black Stars of Ghana was striker Jordan Ayew, one of the sons of Ghanaian great Abede Pele. The 22-year-old Ayew had a hat trick for Ghana, which plays its opening World Cup match June 16th against the USA in Natal, Brazil. Ayew came on as a substitute early in the match in the fourth minute for Majid Waris, who suffered a leg injury. Asamoah John scored Ghana's other goal. Black Stars head coach James Kwesi Appiah says it's fine his team won the match, but there's still work to do ahead of taking on the Americans next week in Natal. And keep in mind, VOA World Cup fans, Ghana has eliminated the USA from the past two World Cups at Germany 2006 and at South Africa 2010. Joining us once again from Johannesburg is our African football guru, David Legg. And David gives us his latest African football quiz question.
Who was the most successful coach of an African team at all the World Cups? Now, I stress an African team. So in other words, it can be a foreign coach or it can be an African coach. Now, what's very important is how you decide who has been the most successful. And what you do, Sonny, is you base it on percentage success. And what you do is you look at the record of each coach. Now, for example, I'm going to pick out one coach, Vidinic. He coached Morocco in 1970, and he coached what was then called Zaire in 1974. So he coached at two consecutive World Cups with different countries. Now, his record, Sonny, and he's obviously not the winner, that's why I can mention him, is 6 matches played, 1 draw and 5 defeats. And unfortunately, the reason he saw his team score only 2 goals but concede 20 is, of course, Zaire were hammered 9-0 at the 1974 World Cup by the then Yugoslavia. So in other words, Sonny, he's played 6 matches now. In each match, you've got 3 points available for a win. So that's a total of 18 points. And he got 1 draw, so he only got 1 point. So what you do is you get that 1 point, you divide it by 18, which is the potential total, and then you multiply by 100, and that's how you work out your percentage success. Because, Sonny, it's the only fair way to do it, because, like, you take a coach like Henri Michel of France. He's coached at 9 matches at the World Cup, and then other coaches have only coached at, say, 3. So I think this is a very fair system. So what we want to know is who has been the most successful coach of an African team at the World Cups, and that's going, Sonny, from 1934 to 2010. And I'm sure you're going to have a very good prize or prizes for the winners, because they're going to sweat a bit on this one, Sonny.
Yes, David, we will have some of those delightful VOA goodies for the winners. Why don't we set a deadline, David, of July 13th, which is when the World Cup final will be played in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. David and I will now give our addresses where you can send your entries. And once again, we have a July 13th deadline for our latest African football quiz question. VOA!
It's david.leg, and leg is spelled L-E-G-G-E, at AFP, that's Agence France Presse, .com. So I'll just repeat that one more time. It's david.leg, L-E-G-G-E, at AFP.com.
You can send me email at sonny@voanews.com. Sonny is spelled S-O-N-N-Y. And pick up a pen or a pencil and a piece of paper. My full postal mailing address is The Sunny Side of Sports, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue Southwest, room 1613, Washington, D.C., 20237.
Voice of America, VOA, Washington.
This is the voice of America, Washington, D.C.
Follow The Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny. If you go to my Facebook page today, Tuesday, you'll see a photo of Ghanaian footballer Jordan Ayew with his fingers pointed upward, celebrating his hat trick against South Korea. As I mentioned earlier, Ghana defeated South Korea Monday night 4-0 in a friendly World Cup warm-up match. And my Twitter handle is at VOA Sunny Sports. Once again, at VOA Sunny Sports. Speaking of Twitter, FIFA will let fans decide the official man of the match for World Cup games in Brazil via a vote on Twitter. Football's world governing body hopes that taking the vote to social media will increase the number of fans who vote. During the 2010 World Cup in South Africa, the man of the match vote was accessible only on the FIFA website. FIFA says voting will be available in 6 languages: English, Spanish, Portuguese, French, German, and Arabic. And I'm going to ask my Egyptian colleague Usama Farag to teach me how to tweet in Arabic. Tweet in Arabic. Yes, I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's The Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Okay, thank you, Sonny. And listen to The Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of The Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
In our feature segment, a new study finds obesity rates for both adults and children are climbing worldwide. And next, a cholera outbreak in the capital of South Sudan, Juba. But first, some music. Here is South Africa's Tiki Ze with Shibodo.
Субтитры сделал DimaTorzok.
Peace.
Africa's Tikize with Shiboto.
Well, a new study finds obesity rates for both adults and children are climbing worldwide, with the greatest gain in weight in developing countries. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
According to the report by international investigators, the number of people carrying extra kilos climbed from 857 million globally in 1980 to more than 2 billion last year. Researchers report 62% of the world's obese individuals live in developing countries. The findings come from an analysis of data gathered from 188 countries in all 21 regions of the world. The study was published in the British medical journal, The Lancet. Investigators discovered the rates of overweight and obesity climbed 28% over the past 33 years. The biggest increase was in children. Almost half of all youngsters and adolescents worldwide are now considered overweight or obese. In developed countries, men have higher rates of obesity than women, although there's evidence that the pace of weight gain in the United States and other Western nations has begun to slow over the past 8 years. Ali Mokhtad is a professor of health metrics and evaluation at the University of Washington and co-author of the study. He blames the easy availability of inexpensive fast food for the obesity pandemic.
Nowadays, food is prepared for us. Remember, in the past, you know, it used to take some time to cook a dish. Now a child, 7, 10 years old, could pop something in a microwave. It's safe and it's readily available. Could open it and eat it.
The authors found some of the highest rates of obesity in China, India, Russia, Egypt, Pakistan, and Indonesia. Places with the highest percentage of overweight people include the sovereign island nation of Tonga, where 50% of the population has a weight problem, along with Libya, Qatar, Micronesia, and Samoa, where more than 50% of women carry excess weight. The healthcare costs of obesity, particularly to developing countries, are enormous, according to Mokhtad.
It has a toll on, you know, our disability, our diseases. And, you know, it was an aging population and we're living longer. No country in the world could afford to spend all the money on treatment. We should find a balance between treatment and prevention.
Without targeted intervention, obesity control programs, and the sustained efforts of national governments, experts say it's unlikely countries will meet the United Nations goal of halting the rise in obesity rates by 2025. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
The capital of South Sudan, Juba, is the site of a cholera outbreak. Businesses say it's costing them a lot of money. Owners of small restaurants and tea stalls say health officials are trying to force them to shut down or install expensive upgrades. Customers say they can no longer find cheap street food to eat. But health officials say these new steps are critical if they are going to end the outbreak. Mugume Davis Rowakarinji has the story from Juba.
On the day Juba's cholera outbreak was announced last month, Juba Mayor Christopher Sarafino said health officials would be traveling around the city, shutting down restaurants and tea stalls that do not follow proper hygiene, including having indoor facilities and using treated water to wash plates and cups. The dozens of small restaurants in Juba's Nyakron market did not meet the new standards. Women used to gather here, serve food cooked in the open air, and served on plastic tables set up under umbrellas. But today, only 6 women are selling food and taking the risk of getting shut down by health officials. Lokia Chandilu is one of them.
Since this issue of cholera started, we are just facing so many problems. Like, I used to have customers in my business. These days, they have reduced. They are saying they don't want us to prepare food because the place is dirty, because we are in open place.
United Nations officials say 29 people have died and more than 1,200 have been infected in South Sudan's current cholera outbreak. The disease is carried in contaminated food and water, which is why health officials are shutting down places they think have a high risk of spreading the disease. They are also encouraging people to increase their hygiene standards. Chandilu says she has a hand-washing facility set up outside and uses clean water. But officials told her she needed to move to a permanent facility and no longer cook in the open. She says she simply can't afford to do that. Lona Bitara says she'll have to give up her business. She says she has relied on the income she made selling tea in the market to feed her 3 children and her unemployed husband.
Since the issue of cholera came, I am not making any profit. But now I don't make anything. I don't make any money. There's no money at all. I don't have food and we don't have clothes. So we are really suffering.
The restaurant owners are not the only ones suffering. Lupai Twaha is a local merchant selling corn, cassava, and beans in the market. He says he can no longer afford to buy food.
Even to eat, it becomes very difficult. We used to get food at £5.
nowadays, even from a big hotels at £30, now it becomes very difficult for us to get that money. We are now suffering here.
But Justin Jogo, a security guard, says he's on the side of health officials. He says he's willing to spend more money or eat less rather than get infected with cholera.
On the way to work, I will not buy things that are outside, things that are not covered. I will not buy it because of cholera, I'm fearing. Because they are not well protected when you buy them.
No new laws have been passed regarding stricter hygiene standards since the cholera outbreak hit. But business owners here say that has not stopped health officials from pressurizing them to shut down. For VOA News, I am Gumedev Suruakarinj in Juba.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Founded in 2000 by the United States and Poland, the Community of Democracies is a group of countries dedicated to supporting nations that are in the midst of democratic transitions. Over the years, the organization has expanded, both in terms of its membership and its outreach to every region of the globe. The community has worked to build task forces staffed with experts to help transitioning democracies with tasks such as constitution writing. The LEND Network, which stands for Leaders Engaged in New Democracies Network, is such a resource. LEND was started by reaching out to about 25 countries that had come through successful democratic transitions and identifying key leaders within these societies. These individuals included a former Chief Justice of South Africa's Supreme Court, who wrote that country's constitution, and the former head of the Chilean army, who led the transition to civilian rule. About 35 former presidents and prime ministers joined this effort through a group known as the Club de Madrid. LEND then teamed up with Google and OpenText and other technology partners to build a platform that allows for real-time voice, video, and text communication with translation between leaders who had been through successful transitions in the past and key leaders in countries that were in the midst of transitions today. This made it possible for leaders in Tunisia who were rewriting their constitution to be able to share their draft with experts all over the world who had experience in the topic under discussion. Immediate translation was available, which allowed for feedback in real time about what had and hadn't worked in the course of prior democratic transitions. In effect, the Tunisians had access to world-class information and were able to develop a first-rate constitution. Looking ahead, the Community of Democracies has already taken an active role in responding to the crisis in Ukraine by sending two assessment missions and is preparing further plans to support the development of strong institutions and the rule of law in Ukraine. The United States is strongly committed to helping democratic transitions around the globe succeed. The Community of Democracies remains an important part of that effort.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials.
Put your flags up in the sky. In
the sky. Hi, this is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. Visit VOAfootball.com for live updates on the World Cup in Brazil. The site is optimized for your mobile phone or tablet and will bring you the latest scores, stats, photos, and videos. And everything can be shared with your friends from your mobile device to Facebook and Twitter. World Cup nonstop at VOAfootball.com.